Hi, I'm Pat Oftrahedy from the Center for Social Media at American University. It is just such a very, very, very great pleasure to see you here. This was an enormously, it was a great, great adventure to be part of the organizing team of this conference and to discover what collaborative unconferencing was like was a real thrill. When we discovered how many of you wanted to come, I was so moved by the momentum that this conversation has taken place that I went to my university and said, can we do a follow-up conference 6 months from now? And they said, yes. So please go to our blog at thecenterforsocialmedia.org if you have any ideas of where we are taking this conversation next for November 10th. I'm moderating a panel on sustainability. I suppose that because this is a conference on public media, we've waited until now and the last 50 minutes of the organized part of the conference to talk about money. But it's, thank you. It's, of course, the key to being able to make stuff happen. So we asked three people with three very different sets of expertise and interest in this to give us an idea of where they see models for funding open media production. Indeed, whether or not it's public media, just to figure out where the emerging models for anybody making any money in this open environment are. We have, I'm not going to give you their full biographies. We've got lots of, you can access that on the web and you can also look at your programs. But let me just tell you who they are on the panel. We're going to start with Diane Myrmigas in the middle, our Hollywood reporter journalist and somebody who you've read, I'm sure, in many venues and is somebody who we really regard as close as it gets to an authoritative source here. We'd like next to turn to Dan Nova, a really, really cool venture capitalist with Highland Capital Partners, who can tell us what he wants to invest in Media 2.0 and why. And finally, we're going to turn to Mark Cooper, who for two decades has been one of the premier researchers in the public interest on media issues in Washington, D.C., and a very, very longtime friend. So we'll start with Diane.
You're up.
And let me just say that we're keeping this to a very tight time frame. Diane is the first one who's going to have to leave us promptly at the end of the panel. So we're going to ask everybody to stick to their 10-minute presentations.
I'm going to try. Thank you. Thanks so much for asking me to be here. I really feel blessed to be here, fortunate. I was at the E3 conference at the beginning of the week speaking, and I feel like I'm running the entire spectrum, the media spectrum, because I've gone from the what is considered by many to be the ultimate convergence platform there to broadcasters, which they're all, whether you're commercial or public, are trying to find their way into an interactive marketplace. So, and also, I have four children at home, and this is not the first time I've seen Second Life. In fact, they have Mom on Second Life, and it's horrifying. So, glad to be here in the flesh. Anyway, you know, the one thing I was thinking while I was listening to everybody today, and I find this all fascinating, is that the challenges and the problems that public media faces is not at all different from what private or commercial media face, in the sense that, you know, you could be Rupert Murdoch or Sumner Redstone from Viacom or Ted Turner, and they're asking the same questions you are. And I know because I sit down with them all the time over the last two decades. But I'll tell you what, you all require the same thing, and that is you need to change your orientation about what you're doing. I'm gonna speak to you like a mother now and as a business an analyst, okay? So forgive me if I give you a few lists to make. You need to embrace interactivity in all things, no question about it. You need to accept the technology empowered consumer and their new behaviors. You need to understand them, study them. You need to redefine your content, advertising, and commerce. You might call it sponsorship. It's still advertising and commerce. You have to reinvent your business models, every single one of them. I don't care who you are. And Time Warner and News Corp feel every bit the pain that you do, believe me. And you have to proceed with post-haste with an entrepreneurial spirit. So there are some new rules of play. Now, these are going to last about 10 seconds, okay, in the great scheme of things, but it's a place to start. And if you make note of some of these things, I'm sure you'll find a way to apply them to your own business. I mean, clearly, when you look at the new media world now, and everybody's right, we're at the very beginnings of this, you can see the need for clear, credible, independent voices and sources of deeper, more thoughtful news in public affairs and culture. It's not there. There are billions of voices out there, and we don't have that, really, okay? The term alternative voices is taking on a whole new meaning in this universe, in this blogging, mashing, searching cyber world that we're in now. The term commercial is taking on a whole new meaning. And it's so much of what the web is about, because interactivity is not just pitching something to somebody. It's actually drilling them down deeper into it and hoping you can transact with them ultimately. So the challenge today is cutting through all of this clutter to connect the niche user slash consumer with the content, the services, the advertisers that they're all interested in, who are all interested in each other. And the internet and interactivity are extremely powerful forces. And they're changing our lives, but you know what? They're changing all of American business. Go through every single industry. So I think what is public media interests need to consider is that what you can bring to this table that so far we have not seen is a very concerted, organized effort to showcase creativity, independent and alternative thinking, the most critical issues of our time, problem solving, which we've raised our children to do ad nauseum, and which really only video games right now give them a chance to do. Credible, legitimate content and information. We've become a headline nation. That's not good enough. We need to drill down, analyze, take it apart, put it back together again, and that way we know where we're going. And we need to link all of this to education in the broadest sense of the word. And I'm not just talking about school education. You know, our lives in this new universe that we're in are all about education every day, and aren't we lucky? But let's make the most of it. Let's not just fill it with blogs and cute comments and quickie games, and they all have their place, don't get me wrong. I'm a good time, Charlie, just like the next person. But, you know, it's time to start thinking about really important issues that are going to very quickly come to the surface here, and how you can plug into them and address them in ways that will not only assure your survival, but will make you money. And it's okay to make money, okay? I was thinking today while we were going through the litany of things with each panel, think about just these three really profound things, okay? We're talking about copyrights, which are really important, okay, intellectual property rights. But think about it. Anything that's put on the web these days, unless it's properly protected, and we have no proper protection, has no assured preservation. So what happens to our original ideas and our original works of art, whether they're videos or whatever, writings, what have you, when and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but when anybody who goes on the web can pull it apart and repurpose it, integrate it with anything of their own making, and put it back out there as an original work. And suddenly original works of art fall deeper and deeper away from the surface. That can be dangerous. It can be wonderful, but it can be dangerous. What about this? Most of what we have on the web right now is deliberately put there. Okay? Again, I love the web. I'm on it all the time. Don't get me wrong. But most companies, most organizations put what you see on there for a reason. They're trying to push information. Most of what Google finds, they find because somebody wrote a story about it, somebody pitched it to somebody, it was an advertisement. And so therefore, what you're connecting with are ideas that have been people who have sought people out. You're not necessarily getting the things that you'd like to see. And on the other hand, you might just be looking for things you want, information that you want, and be missing the big picture. You know, if we only get what's on our playlist and on our bookmarks, then all we're ever knowing, all we're ever learning about are the things that immediately interest us. Whatever happened to the front of the New York Times? or the front of the Wall Street Journal, or all those stories that we just happened to hit on while we were searching through a paper, physically searching through a paper. So we're suddenly creating, potentially creating, an information vacuum. So if I were reinventing public media today, I would look at the strengths that you have. I would look at your branded content. I would look at the way that you can fill voids in the marketplace, and there are real voids, and then I'd look at ways to monetize it. I would look at what's being done in other areas. For instance, right now on the commercial broadcast front, the Scripps Network, Hearst Argyle, CBS and MTV, the BBC abroad, they're all pushing the envelope in terms of trying to weave interactivity with the broadcast model, which is essentially passive. It's a one-way media, and it's very hard, unless you're willing to step back and pull it apart, it's very hard to realize that you could actually be more creative, be more lucrative, be a happier medium if you learned to use interactivity. You know, local TV stations, which are, I think are face the toughest challenge of all right now, they're being wildly abandoned by all of their networks, but they've made as much as $1 billion this past year just by selling advertising on their websites. But that isn't being interactive, okay? So I would suggest a couple things here. I would suggest, number one, looking at new technology and products and platforms that will help you as broadcasters be interactive. Look at Brightcove, which I won't go into any of these right now because there's no time, but Brightcove. TiVo products, okay? We thought that they were going to skip across advertising. Now they suddenly introduced a new product this week where they will actually help you find advertisements for things that you want to see. Okay, they'll aggregate them. The iPods and the Sling boxes. Open TV, Visible World, and then you look at companies that need your business as a public medium. Google, their analyst day, they spent the entire, Eric Schmidt spent his entire analyst day pitch on local, the power of local, the local community connections that you have as public media. Look at Walmart. Walmart and Lexus and Microsoft are among the advertisers that are spending $50 million on testing online auctions. There's money to be made in that. Let's see. I just wanted to mention a couple other really important ones. Oh, okay.
In your last minute.
Yes, in my last minute. Okay. Tom Wolzine last week, or no, 2 weeks ago at NAB, mentioned the importance of working with cable operators in your communities. Let me get to the next slide, too. This is your to-do list. Oh, no, it's over here. I'm sorry. There we go. Public broadcaster's to-do list. He mentioned the importance of working with cable operators.
Who?
Do you have it here?
Yeah,
okay, thanks. Sorry. Because cable operators need the expertise that you have and the connections you have with the community. They have not been very successful in selling local advertising. And while local advertising may not be a direct function of public broadcasting per se, you do have local sponsors. There is content you could bring to them, and they can help you close the loop. They can make you interactive. He recommended this because he said that if any broadcaster were to really cultivate this closed loop with their cable operators in their areas, that they would increase their revenue growth in the next 3 years by 20%. That's compared to a 4% growth in their local advertising revenues as projected. Another way is to work with advertisers. Advertisers desperately want to become interactive, but they need to reach your local constituents. And another way to do it is to align yourselves with the equipment people, everybody from iPod to Microsoft, everybody who's trying to get into the living room now with the network tome, align yourselves with them. There's just so many places. I guess my bottom line is there's so many places in this new universe to make money and to advance your art and who you are, your brand. And I would just advise you to look at it as a half full, not half empty kind of proposition, that for every challenge, and they're all formidable, there's at least two opportunities. Thanks so much.
And we're looking forward next year to Diane's book on the changing platforms in media.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Nova with Highland Capital Partners, and I'm here to really present to you over the next 5 to 10 minutes an investor's perspective on Web 2.0. Diane mentioned cutting through the clutter. Well, this is what the clutter looks like to me. It's, I guess I could have titled this talk, Finding the Needle in the Haystack, and this is just a subset of that haystack. And as much as a blog is written every second or two, a company is funded every single day. So the good news is that there is a lot of capital out there for the Web 2.0 world. Venture capitalists are very well funded and very, very excited about the 2.0 world. So why are investors excited? I'd like to touch base really on three things. One, the markets are huge and are growing rapidly. I'll spend a minute on that. The business models are very, very attractive and unprecedented, and acquisitions are increasing. So when we think about it from an investor's point of view, our job is to make investments in great companies and great people, but also eventually we need to find a path to liquidity. Liquidity happens either through an IPO or through an acquisition, and we'll talk about some of those acquisitions. But when we look at the market, I'm really going to define it just with three examples. If you look at the audience, for instance, at MySpace, over the last 12 months, they've gone from 15 million unique visitors per month up to now close to 50 million unique visitors per month. That's all in 1 year. YouTube did not exist this time last year, and they have now a population of 6.5 million users per month. And then finally, Technorati, which went a little sideways for several months. Since December, they've gone from less than 500,000 unique visitors to well over 4.5 million. So again, from an investor's point of view, we want to make sure there's a real market that's growing. And just, you know, these three companies alone demonstrate that there's definitely demand and need and interest in this space from a user's point of view. When we talk about attractive models from an investor's perspective, and I've been around investing in 1.0, 2.0 models for now 11 years, it used to be, if you build it, they will come. Now it's, if they build it, they will come, which speaks to the participatory nature of what's happening here. And again, when they build it and they will come, it has significant implications for the cost structures and the business models that we're looking at. Specifically, what's happening is when we think about it from an investor's point of view, we want to figure out how much does it cost to acquire a consumer or a customer? How much does it cost to get a customer to a site? And with the participatory nature of what's happening, the customer acquisition costs are very, very low. It's also they're also fairly low retention costs, because if you're participating, you're coming back. The marketing costs are low as well. The content development costs are also incredibly low, again, based on the users participating in developing the content for that business. And the technology costs are incredibly low when you look at the cost of open source technology and the falling prices of disk drives and servers and so on. So from a cost structure point of view, this is really, you know, from my perspective, unprecedented in terms of what it takes to build a business today. And then I look at it from the user's point of view. It's an incredibly compelling user value proposition. Most of these sites, like YouTube and MySpace and others, I don't want to focus just on those, are very, very simple to use. They're effective. They accomplish what they're meant to do. They're very dynamic. As you know, they change rapidly every single minute. They're entertaining and they're participatory. Now, acquisitions are happening and more will happen. So this speaks to the third point, which when I think about making an investment, I need to think about eventually how I'm going to get my money back, hopefully with a profit. And what's happening in the traditional media world, and you just have to turn to the Boston Globe earlier this week to see the circulation numbers decreasing throughout the country. You look at traditional media and they're being squeezed. So what does that mean? Well, first of all, from an investor's perspective, they have a lot of cash. They need to do something. There's significant upside if they're right in making an acquisition. And the downside is fairly limited. A lot of these acquisitions are not going to break the bank for some of these large media companies. When you think about the New York Times, IAC, News Corp, they can afford to take this risk. New media to me is now defined by Yahoo and Google and others. They're also concerned because they've been tremendously successful with their own business model, but those models are changing quickly. They also have lots of cash. There's huge downside if they do nothing and stay complacent, but there's continued upside if they're right. So we have kind of a perfect storm evolving here. From an acquisition point of view, you've got old media competing with new media to buy new media. And it's going to continue, and from an entrepreneurial perspective, that's a healthy thing. So I'll just spend the next few minutes talking about how Highland evaluates an opportunity specifically, because we're not like all other venture capitalists. We look at it based on stage. There are companies that are pure startups, there are companies kind of at the middle stage, and then some at the later stage. And what you'll see is a common thread, whether it's early, mid, or late, we focus on the people. It's all about people to us, the team and the founders. Early on, it's very much about the idea and the competition and how close that idea is to the competitive offerings. We also look at the time and cost to bring the product or service to market. And we're not really focused on the business model. We're not focused on where the revenues are coming from just yet. We're not focused on what the profit characteristics of the business will be. We're really focused on getting the right team in place, the right technology, the right strategy, the right offering, and that eventually will come if you build the foundation right. And in the valuation, these businesses are valued at a fairly tight range early on, usually in the what I'd call the single-digit million-dollar valuation, somewhere between $0 and $5 million up front. Mid-stage companies, these are companies now without really a business model, but they're growing like crazy. And this is a very, very dangerous space from an investor's point of view to invest in, because you're really at this point investing in the buzz. You're investing in growth of unique users, and we look at user quality. We don't think all users are the same. So, for instance, I would value a social networking site full of moms, where moms are advising other moms on what baby food to feed their child who might be lactose intolerant. That's very valuable from a media and an advertising point of view compared to, say, two teenagers who are just talking about where they're going to go out over the weekend. Again, now page views and repeat visits become more important. The business model, again, is becoming more important, but not yet really that important. Valuation at this point is a wide range because it's all based on the buzz, and that's why it's very dangerous from an investor's point of view to invest at this stage, because you really can't get your arm around the numbers. The valuations are very high, which is great for an entrepreneur, but from an investor's perspective, it's really a bet on a bet. It's a bet on the buzz continuing, and as you know, some companies are here today and gone tomorrow, so it's a tricky space. What's less tricky is some of the later stage companies, which we look at every now and then, and now again, it's about the team, revenue, margins, growth, sustainability, profitability, visibility. The business model now is very important, and where the valuation is really based on the metrics of revenue and profit at that point. So it would be higher price typically, but certainly lower risk. So in summary, you know, we take this haystack and we try to sift through it, and we try to figure out how and where some of the biggest winners of our day will come from. And what I like to do is I look back at history, and I look at what's important. And for me, it's all about being part of a huge market, simple and focused, founders who are active and a missionary. Eventual great management teams are built around that. There needs to be constant improvement, insane customer focus, and an annuity-like model. Well, what companies fit that bill? We have Apple right down to Craigslist, and if you kind of look at what boxes they might check, you'd see that most of these great companies check almost all of these boxes. So I think that's my 10 minutes, and look forward to questions later. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dan.
I'm one. Okay. So I'm a trained as a sociologist. I'm a part-time academic and a full-time activist. And people who know me know that I always go straight at things. So I want to start with a simple observation. Having sat here today, I discovered that almost everyone who has presented a business model that is based on charity or advertising. And I frankly think that we need a different model, better grounded in civil society, if we are to have a sustainable public media with a public purpose, or as Jamie said this morning, a social media with a social message. Now, if you look at the paper, I started 3 years ago, and it'll seem a little dated, because 3 years ago I had to spend a lot of time convincing people that a revolution was about to happen. Actually, the paper was born in a conversation with a, an independent TV producer who wanted to start a new independent network, who ended up at my door because I was the guy who fought the cable company. I hate to admit it, we actually fought the 84 Cable Act, so I've been doing this a little longer than 2 decades. He said, how do I get carriage on the expanded basic tier? My answer was simple. The bad news is you don't. They'll never let you have it. But the good news is you don't need it. This is not a drive-by world. It's a URL world. Go VOD and the internet. In the new world, just being there is not so important. People have to know your address. Distribution is not the problem. Attention is the problem. It turns out for public media, even attention's not the problem. Monetization is the problem, which is what I'm going to talk about. But I think the internet, the revolution is clear. We have 48 million bloggers. We have 7 million podcasts. We have 2 of the top 5 broadcast producers are now putting their content on the web for free. The revolution has arrived. Time Warner and ABC have now put their stuff up on the web for free. There is no doubt about that. I did pull one slide from the paper. A lot of them are probably irrelevant, because this one shows a little history. This one looks at the path of commercial mass media, or mass media in general, and it shows that essentially what we understand is when the mass media hit 50%, they become dominant. Fireside chats on the radio in the 1930s, Dick Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow in the 1960 presidential debates, and the bloggers in 2004. The internet has arrived as a political medium. So that's important to realize. The internet is 30 years old, and it interconnected networks. The World Wide Web is 15 years old, and by hyperlinking the content in those networks, it became much more valuable. But broadband is only about 10 years old, which gave us that always-on connection, which is so important, and a lot of bandwidth. But even that bandwidth wasn't enough. Peer-to-peer was the key. Torrenting is the key. The revolution has just begun. But it's clearly quite here, is here, and we now know how quickly it can happen. Also note that I've changed the unit of analysis. We measured radios by household, we measured TV by household, we measure the internet by individuals. This is a new society, very important. I remember 6 years ago here at the Berkman Center, I was debating network neutrality, and Charlie Nesson actually remembered this, and I said, you can't be a narrowband company in a broadband world. And AOL has found that out. You can't be a narrowband company in a broadband world. Well, today, you can't be a one-way company in a two-way world. The old media pushed content out at us for so long that they came to believe, as a species, we were mute couch potatoes. Of course, they were wrong. The minute we got the ability to speak and create, we exploded with production and creation and exchange of content. That's the revolution we heard about. Now, they can add features and try to get interactivity, but they cannot give us the essential thing we need, which is we're no longer passive, we're no longer isolated, we're no longer sedentary. We're active, migratory, connected. We are creators, users, and speakers. The old media, then, will try to figure out to make ways we feel that we're having participation and interactivity. The new media gives us the real ability to participate. Now, I put up 2 different models here, one I call networked individual and one I called Inc. TV, independent non-commercial television. I've changed the title, as you can see, at the beginning to independent non-commercial video. I firmly believe that both of these models are absolutely necessary to our success, to have a public media with a public message. You've heard almost entirely about the networked individualism today. And the way you make money in a networked individual world is you provide platforms for individuals to speak to other individuals. But I think we also need the other model. We need investigative journalism. We need resources to produce high-quality content. 40 million bloggers is less than 1% of the world's population. 40 million bloggers is less than 1% of the world's population. We need to talk and reach the other 99%. So how do we do that? Well, if we look at the characteristics of the internet, we really find an interesting thing. People like the internet because it's useful, timely, and convenient. But look at what it doesn't have. Local TV beats it on trust and providing news people need. Survey's a year old or so. So local TV beats the internet on two characteristics. Really interesting. What we have to do is figure out how to provide those characteristics. And that's where I suggest we form what I like to call participatory cooperatives. Most Americans don't realize this, but one out of every two Americans is a member of a cooperative here in the heart of capitalism, here in the most raging, pure free market capitalist society in the world. One out of every two Americans is a member of a cooperative. Credit unions are the dominant cooperatives. Food co-ops are around. Farmer co-ops, I don't consider tenant co-ops because they're not voluntary. If you move in the building, you got to join. Credit unions are, in fact, voluntary. So, and why do these people join credit unions? They do because they're a trust institution. Almost as many people volunteer to be on boards of credit unions as work in the commercial banking industry. So Americans will actually do this, and they participate because they trust that financial institution. Information is a trust good, just like financial services. Second question is, how can we fill their need for what they want in news? Remember, we were low, we couldn't even beat local TV on relevant news. Well, the answer is to let people decide what to put on, and you heard glimpses of that. Make them members. This is not a subscription model. I'm not talking about subscribers, because subscribers just pay to get stuff. Members decide what to put on and what to get. And I suggest there's a trade-off between the quality of content and the participation and the willingness to listen. You don't have to be all that slick if you're telling a story that is meaningful to people. So I think those two characteristics actually flow from this looking for a base in civil society, finding people who will pay a couple bucks a month to participate in actively producing the stuff that they get a chance to look at. Now, when I present this view, I get pushback from two really interesting places. Social activists who usually say, we want people in civil society to be more active, more involved. The politicians have to listen to civil society. And then I say, well, fine, let's fund our media from civil society. They say, no, we want public money. The government should do that. Frankly, you can never speak truth to power on power's nickel. If you intend to change government, you have to fund yourself in civil society. The second pushback comes from the professionals. They really are concerned about giving the camera over to the people, worried about the deprofessionalization of the production of content. Unfortunately, deprofessionalization, from one point of view, is the democratization of the production of culture from the other. We need to find a balance between those professionals who can really do the investigative journalism that we need and fund it, and letting the people put their own media on. And I think there is a place to go. Now, this space has gotten very, very complicated. Okay, so this space is getting very, very complicated. What I've done here is taken the three fundamental functions of a newspaper or a news medium. They report, they edit, and they control responses. Old media does closed reporting. They hire professional reporters. They do closed editing. They have professional editors. And they control the responses. So the New York Times prints all the news that its editors think is fit to print. Its reporters can write up, and then they give 1% of their space to letters to the editor. Every other media you have heard today breaks this model a little bit. Takes it in a different direction. And the two extremes you've heard, Google News on one side, a pure aggregator. They do no reporting, no editing, and no response. And you heard Gather, Wikipedia, IndyMedia on the other side. Everything is open. But folks, let's understand that all of these models have different functions. And so we can have different mixes of open and closed. And my hypothesis, my suggestion is that if you give members a chance to participate within this space, and I assume that you will never charge, that is, for Gather, which apparently I assume is advertiser supported, Wikipedia, which is purely voluntarily supported, I don't think you can charge in that space, but in these other spaces, imagine a membership model where people know that they're getting a chance to do open participatory one of the functions, and I suspect the more functions you let them do, the more they're liable to pay, especially when they see themselves as members of an organization that will have influence beyond their small community, because people really do like to influence the process. They like to communicate, they like to participate, and now we've got the chance to have that revolution. Oh, didn't have to.
Thank you.
Yeah, that wasn't a tomato.
Okay, we're just about ready for questions, and we have a bunch on our list of questions, and I'd also like to hear from members of the audience, but before doing so, I'd like to ask our other two panelists. Dan, have you seen business models of the kind that Mark is talking about, a membership model for promoting media?
Yeah, I have. There aren't many. I think it makes a lot of sense. But practically speaking, I don't think we as users are there and ready to pay for content, except maybe in the box that Mark talked about. You know, the fact is, just as an example, you know, iPod users on average have only paid for 12 songs each. I mean, there's huge demand for music, but when it comes to paying for music, it's 12 songs per iPod. So I think as a society, people will pay for quality and constant quality, but that model today is not really apparent.
And Diane?
I wanted to add two things. One is I think we really need to be careful about making too many assumptions about what consumers are going to pay for. And don't be fooled by these initial trials, these $1.99 downloads or, you know, whatever, because they are just that. They're trials. And you can be sure that consumers are not going to want to be nickel and dime to death. I'm sure none of you out there want to be. So what I think we're looking at is very quickly in the next 18 months, the evolution of subscription-based models, but maybe not in the traditional sense, where people will want to buy their content one time, be able to play it across all their devices, upload it, download it, and whatever. Okay? Economically, that's the only thing that makes sense. So whatever form that takes, it takes. The other thing is, I think that people will pay to drill down into the areas that they're interested in. So in other words, you know, if I really want something, and this kind of speaks to Mark's point, if I really want to influence something or really get into something beyond the superficial level of it, I may pay what is, you call it a membership fee, call it whatever kind of access fee it is, for additional information. You see this model starting to evolve on the net all over the place, in many different places. So those are two, but you've got to keep an open mind about how people will pay for things and what they'll pay for.
We pay for content today, right? It's not just in the traditional Web 2.0 format, but I do see a time when we'll be paying for content in the future.
And that might have been one answer to the most popular question, why is there so much focus on advertising versus pay-for-download or item models, for instance, no viable paid subscription podcast service?
One thing I would say about advertising is that, you know, by and large, television, has thrived because it is a commercial enterprise. And even if public broadcasting doesn't want to consider itself as such, it certainly is, you know. And if you think that a government that's got gazillion dollars in deficit and growing every day is going to, you know, increasingly fund media, I think you're smoking something. Because to be honest with you, you know, you really have to make it on your own. But as I said, there are plenty of places to make it on your own if you really want to. And the times have never been better to have the tools at hand that are absolutely free to do it. So I think it just takes a little ingenuity and a willingness to rethink, you know, your business outside the box. But as far as advertising goes, there's always going to be an element of commercialization or advertising because companies want to sell you products and services. People want to sell you something. And I think that the real threat to the internet within the next 5 years is becoming just a commercial enterprise.
Well, the reason I think people are so focused on advertising is we've built up this advertising model over the past 40 years or so, certainly on the TV side. Huge numbers of bucks go into advertising, and the advertisers know that the eyeballs are not there anymore. So they need to spend this money, they keep spending it, and as they discover that the eyeballs are not there anymore, they're trying to figure out where the eyeballs are. They have this complete compulsive need to see if they can get their products in front of people's faces. So you have this huge pile of money that wants to be spent. And it's just so attractive that everyone wants to figure out how they can grab a part of it without asking, and I think, the fundamental question of who you are when you do and what you want to be over the long term. But so in a certain sense, advertising dollars are low-hanging fruit.
You know what, though? One quick thing about advertising, to just to speak to their point. You know, advertisers are showing an amazing willingness to shift their money into the web. Now, you know, it's still small potatoes when you compare it to all media spending in the United States. But the one thing that they realize they're getting on the internet is accountability and measurability. And that's huge, because then you know for sure you're connecting with the right eyeballs, the ones that you're most likely to do a transaction with, if not immediately, at some point in the future. And MTV, for instance, has been able to document this by showing that their CPMs, their prices per unit, they're able to sell to advertisers at a premium that's 3 times what they charge them on their cable networks. That's just the beginning. So, you know, there is definitely, this is going to continue to be very much an advertising-supported platform, without question.
You guys are knocking off these questions. There's, as you can see, a question dealing with whether sponsors are going to pay for advertising on the web with the same valuation that they pay for it in mass media. And I think that your answer spoke to that to some to some degree.
Yeah.
Okay, and I know that we have pubcasters in the audience, and I would love to hear what some of you think about these proposals to fund public media.
The thought is that, now I'll ease off, you were, I think, saying, and maybe I didn't quite get it right, that people will pay to participate because they want to have an impact that is greater than what they might have just in their own local community. So if I have that right, my question is, in New Hampshire, for example, we have the third largest elected representative body in the world, I suppose. We have 400 members of our House of Representatives, with the consequence that not any of them can be said to have great power. Now, that's not the way it exactly works out, but if I understand your model correctly, and all these people are paying because they want to have influence and they get to post their content, doesn't this sheer volume of all of their content dilute their impact and dilute the value of their participation?
So you've described the central problem of the representative democracy, right? If you've got all those representatives, you want the ratio of the representative to the people to be small, and then you get too many representatives. In fact, I think that if you look at effective internet-based organizations that establish, if they are activists as such, when they establish themselves, establish really good two-way relationships with their members, manage those relationships carefully in the sense that, and now I'm talking about a local issue. So we have a local school board election or a local, that kind of local issue. If those activists organize and disseminate information and use input to the political process, they can, in fact, influence the process. And having done so once, each time they succeed, they will hang around longer and longer and longer. A little bit of reward in the political process pays off a lot. So you're absolutely right. In a certain sense, organization is the way you magnify your voice. And judging from the willingness of people to participate and produce, judging from the desire of people to influence and be effective, well-managed public media that has that kind of purpose, I think will have a public as opposed to an audience. So you magnify your voice through organization. You magnify it through presence in the media.
I was just going to put one postscript on that, if I could. That's what we call value added, okay? That's essentially what people are going to be willing to pay for on the internet, is value added, something that they aren't getting at the top. They're interested enough in it. They want to participate. They want to get more information. They want to do something with the information, maybe manipulate it for analytical purposes or whatever. That value added level is where you're going to have people willing to pay a fee.
I wanted to pick up a question. I want you, but wait one second until pick up a question on the list, which deals with the challenge that Mark put forward, and he's not the first person to put it forward, and implicitly the other two people on this panel have somewhat agreed with him, that it's the federal government is both a tough place to look for more money at this moment for public media, and also maybe you don't want to have those strings attached to your project. The question has been asked, what about the role of government in investing in infrastructure, skill set, incubator development, et cetera? Obviously, this refers to the fact that there is a lot of implicit subsidy in the system now, or implicit denial of subsidy in the role of government in the kind of regulation that's put forward. So I wanted to know what people on this panel think about that question, about supporting policies that enable people to participate in participatory media.
There's no doubt that the government has been supporting the wrong people for the better part of a century. And you know what? That was a terrible mistake, and we tried ways to fix it with obligations and whatnot. It didn't work. That model has not worked. The notion of imposing public interest obligations on people who have broadcast licenses, who become fabulously wealthy because of it, who have massive voices because of it, simply has not created an environment that's healthy for democracy. In my opinion, even if we had the political power to make them start sending the money in a different way, that money would always be politically determined. There will always be a board of directors or a set of trustees who will have to decide, and they will become a different set of gatekeepers in the political process. So what role should government play here? I think what government should do is obviously provide the space for people to speak, right? We want a large chunk of the airwaves back. So they ought to unlicense the spectrum so that more of us can use it. All these people sitting here in Wi-Fi are the garbage bands of the spectrum. Imagine what we could do if we had really good stuff to deliver services over. Municipalities ought to provide the basic subway system for the information age, municipal wireless systems, right? That is infrastructure that enables people to speak. I think the next step of expecting the government to pay for it, by the time you got the political power to do that, the space will be so cluttered with the commercial guys, I'm not sure you'll be able to take it back. And B, even when you had that political power, it will always be a political process. So my notion here is to shrink the role of government or expand it in some sense by giving people the chance to better speak and then proving that we can use that space by grounding ourselves in civil society to fund our production of content.
Quick responses so that our gentleman in back.
I totally agree. I think this is it's time for public media to be public. And that means having to compete in a free market for dollars and for attention and support, just like everybody else. But quite frankly, I don't think that is an intimidating notion, because this is an open market now, truly open market, where it's consumer driven, the individual voice is there. I think if the internet demonstrates anything, it's that there's plenty of individual, corporate, even groups that are passionate enough about things to find a way to support them. And I totally agree with that government should provide infrastructure only, at least for emergency uses, if nothing else. There's plenty of civil justification for an infrastructure, and that they should back off. I think that we just don't need any more regulation. And I think if they sell the spectrum, the analog spectrum, like they're thinking about, flipping it to the telcos and some of the cable companies, that we're just going to have more big media in charge of what's out there.
In the back.
First off, thanks for speaking today. My name is Alvis Bridges. I'm a reality TV story producer who's now writing a pop culture book about the future. And I'm in love with Web 2.0, just like everyone else here. I can see the model moving into even reality television and into every domain. What I'd like to get a sense of is what you all think are the broader economic ramifications of this. You know, obviously there's a ton of upside here for a lot of people locally and in, small pockets. So what is the, effect on the broader U.S. economy in the next, say, 2 to 5 years? And what's the effect on the world economy of, Web 2.0 and participatory mechanisms in the same time frame?
I wish people would not ask such narrow, tiny little questions. Yeah, well,
I mean, to me, the impact, and if you look at the paper, at the beginning of the paper talks about the digital revolution has a dramatic effect on reducing the minimum efficient scale necessary to be a successful producer of content, right? You can do it on a much smaller budget and make a good living at it. You have to find your revenue models, but you don't have to be a massive capital-intensive, concentrated record company or movie studio to actually produce content. And of course, all those 2 million video podcasts has diversified the production of culture dramatically. Some of those people are trying to make a little money, a lot of them are not. I mean, so for me, the key is the reduction of the cost of production. The impact, I think the Napster rebellion, and I consider it a rebellion as part of the digital revolution, has fundamentally changed the revenue model for the recording industry, reduced it by 20% or 30%, squeezed out a substantial part of the monopoly rents that was in it, allowed other people to compete with it. So at one level, we will measure our economic output much lower because we measure exchange value in our economy. If we measured use value, we would find it growing dramatically. Let me give a simple example. Everybody in this room on that Wi-Fi network is using the spectrum. We don't count that in our exchange economy because it's essentially use, not exchange. Everybody in this room has a cell phone in their pocket, almost everybody. They have paid a bunch of money for that cell phone, and that will get counted. But this room proves that they're counting the wrong thing. They're counting exchange and not use. So in my answer is that the economy will become much stronger and closer to the people's needs, even though it will appear as though it is not growing as fast as it would have if we didn't let these people use Wi-Fi.
I just want to add to that real quick is that what we're seeing right now is the new media world being assessed and forecasted on old media models. Business models. And that's kind of a dangerous place to be because the old ones aren't quite working right anymore, and every day that passes, they're becoming less credible. And the spending models are shifting. We don't know how much money is attached to the new consumer use of media. And to be honest with you, we don't even know what the next level, and I mean like the next level in 100 levels of creativity is going to be on the so-called internet or from interactivity. And that's going to be commoditized at some point. Every level you create, it's new, there's an initial reaction to it, that's worth something. It levels off, you monetize what you do, that's worth something. Then it gets commoditized, and you go on to the next level. And you can see it in every stage of every kind of media we've ever had in this country. So that's going to happen again. And this is a hugely important force, not just in media and entertainment and telecommunications and the internet, but in every level of business and every kind of business, not just in this country, in the world. I think PricewaterhouseCoopers, their last report, and they're coming out with another one soon, they said something like they projected it was like $3 trillion that it was going to bring. It represented $3 trillion of spending globally. I don't have the exact number, but something like that. When you take all of that kind of big media, spending, broad media spending into consideration. So the thing that I think we need to be careful of is assuming too much, because we're making our assumptions on old media principles and values without really understanding or knowing yet what the emerging ones are. And the consumer is key because they're driving everything. They'll decide.
Dan.
Very briefly, to the question, I think what the 2.0 world represents, when I think about 1.0, you know, 1.0 was the ultimate democratization of information, making information available to everybody everywhere who had access to the internet. What 2.0 does, it really allows for the ultimate democratization of participation and contribution, which to me is very powerful when you think about world boundaries and who can contribute what, because everybody is an expert in something. And now with the 2.0 world, we're able to benefit from worldwide expertise, both on an individual basis and a group basis. So I'm pretty excited about it.
One more question.
I have a quick observation, then a quick question. Oh, Terry Heaton here. Hi, everybody. In terms of getting into the ammunition business, one of the things that WKRN in Nashville is doing is they're setting up a subscription model where people will be able to purchase MPEG-4 files of selected raw news footage that people can then reuse any way they want. The station owns the footage, owns all the rights to it, and so that is a business model that never would have been possible.
And no digital rights management on the material?
Correct. And the question is for Dan. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but if 2.0 is bottom-up or peer-to-peer, and the bottom, to me, is people in our communities and neighborhoods and whatever, then why doesn't the investment community look at local business models and local opportunities and grow them outward instead of trying to take a concept, build it globally, and then shrink it down to the local level? Is there a bias against that kind of business, or don't they exist?
No, I think they exist. I mean, Craigslist started out as a very local business, right? It started out in San Francisco and one other city, now has really expanded certainly nationally. And we like business models that are perfected locally. And if the model works locally, you know, the question then becomes, can we expand to one other market? If we can expand to one other market, can we expand to 10 other markets? So I like models that start locally, lower risk, prove the model, perfect it, and then roll it out. And I think that's happening.
Pat, let me, one point, and this is a point that you raised earlier. Under the oppressive thumb of the old media oligopoly, most musicians made all their money doing that ancillary sales stuff anyway, right? They sold all this other stuff, and because they never made any money in their contracts because of the way the damn contracts were written, right? So in point of fact, one important source of revenue for this stuff is, in fact, all the other things you do as you're a creator, perhaps, right? And it's a very important, especially when your minimum efficient scale gets small, you don't need to sell too much other stuff in order to make a living. And that's what the democratic production of culture is about. So the side sales are very important.
Well, we've managed to raise a lot of other big thorny issues, along with the big thorny issue of how to pay for anything, and it includes the role of government and the role of private censorship as well through stuff like digital rights management. The questions that have been raised in the question list are really good. They ought to spur a lot of conversation online and offline as we go forward. Thank you very much.